Hi, hello. We have a jam-packed episode of the Dunker Spot coming your way. First, on the NBA side, we catch up with the latest transactions over the weekend. We also get to tap in with some Summer League action. We got California Classic. We got some Salt Lake City Summer League. We talk about what we saw and what we liked. Then we shift to the W side. We talk about the race for the eighth seed, the Chicago Sky making a lineup change, and we have some salutes in order for a couple of great players. We hope you have fun with this episode. Rock with us. Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of the Dunker Spots. We are part of the Yahoo Sports Network. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, the always excellent Steve Jones Jr. Steve, happy Tuesday. How are you?
Feeling good, feeling great. Happy to be here. Excited to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, for once again embracing your bounce. Ready to hoop it up, Nikias. Let's get to the basketball, though. Of it all.
Let's get to the basketball indeed. Before we get going, just a quick note for the newer listeners and more specifically the newer watchers of the Dunker Spot podcast, as we've gotten some comments. Just a quick reminder that the NBA section for us, if you're watching on YouTube, is going to be on this here channel, the Yahoo NBA YouTube channel. For those looking for the W work, that's going to be on the main Yahoo Sports YouTube channel. So we do have the split. Maybe we'll include the links to both of those videos, y'all can get to those a little bit easier, but wanted to give the quick reminder there as we got some comments on the last video, so wanted to make sure that was made clear. But Steve, before we started recording, we got some news hitting the pipeline about 20 minutes before we got started. Donovan Mitchell and the Cleveland Cavaliers agreeing to a max contract extension, 4 years, over $273 million, a player option on the final year of the contract for Donovan Mitchell. He could have taken this into next offseason and gotten an extra year, instead decides to commit now. And so he is fully locked in. Are you surprised that Donovan Mitchell chose to do so a year so early on the extension front? Because I think bringing him back feels like a no-brainer if you're Cleveland.
No, I'm not surprised by Donovan Mitchell saying I will commit to Cleveland, especially the way that last season ended. I think the interesting part is, you know, him being all in. The Knicks did what they did to Cleveland. Donovan Mitchell apologized to the city of Cleveland. No, there's not going to be a cloud over our head. Like, I'm going to stay. Don't worry about that. We're good. That's off the table. The interesting part to me is the era we're in where it feels like not two timelines, but two different things are being served at the same time. Because we're coming off yesterday where Brad Stevens was like, hey, feels kind of rough with this amount of our cap being tied to specifically Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum, right? Mm-hmm. That was part of the explanation. But we have lived in this world where we have a chance to just keep our talent. We'll keep our talent. If we have to trade them down the road, we'll trade them down the road. Mm-hmm. But how do we merge these two? Can they both coexist? What are your thoughts on that? Am I off base here thinking this way?
No, I think it is fascinating in light of the broader conversations we've been having about Cleveland's core. Like, what does Donovan Mitchell next to Darius Garland? They're talented, but they're small. You now get James Harden, who opted out, expected to be back in Cleveland. But obviously, we're all in a holding pattern on the LeBron situation. But that isn't the best defensive backcourt. What does that look like? Jared Allen plus Evan Mobley. They're great defensively, but will Evan Mobley shoot well enough to make that work? What does it look like in a playoff context, et cetera? And so Cleveland making this bet in a vacuum, Donovan Mitchell is an all-NBA talent. Let's re-sign our all-NBA talent. Within the broader context of Cleveland, and to your point, what we are coming off of with Boston trading Jaylen Brown is like, okay, what do you have to show for it? Right now, it is just the Eastern Conference Finals berth that ended the way that it ended. And so do you have the belief in this core four to push forward, take another step in the East, get to the finals, potentially win the finals? If not, what's going to be the first pivot? Because I would find it hard to believe that you re-sign Donovan Mitchell now, and then next year, if it's a second round exit or something, okay, let's trade Donovan Mitchell. Not impossible. We have seen crazier things in the NBA, but that would seem like a quick pivot. And so with him being locked in, we're waiting on James Harden to come back. I would imagine that would be like a 2-year deal or 3-year deal with some partial guarantees. We'll see. Does the attention now just shift to, hey, Evan Mobley, are you actually going to take an offensive leap this year or a bigger one this year? If not, you may be the guy. Like, I guess that's kind of where the brain goes from a roster construction standpoint. Is that fair?
No, I think that's a solid point, because I think if you're a team, you have to have your son. We orbit around this player. This is our person, and we want to keep them here as long as we possibly can and avoid them knocking on our door and being like, hey, I would like to not be here anymore. And then once you lock that person in, it's like, okay, what do we get around them? slot wise. And then, okay, how do we shift this team if that part doesn't work? So I think there's a lot of things that teams are trying to figure out in this era. But I think for Cleveland, you got to feel good just knowing, okay, we don't have to deal with a whole lot of that. We can wait on LeBron, and then we can get Big Jim back, and we can try and make another run at it. So salute to Donovan Mitchell. The numbers, like, it's – everyone wants to yell at how much people are getting made or the percentage of the cap, but salute. I am always going to be a fan of people getting paid. So thumbs up from me.
There you go. That is fair. One question I'll toss to you, and then we can transition. What is your playoff concern level in regards to Donovan Mitchell? Because I think what we've gotten with a larger sample in Cleveland, going back to Utah, et cetera, is that he will get the buckets. There are still the defensive questions. There are some of the playmaking questions for him. Is there any concern for you that this maybe doesn't age as well as Cleveland wants it to in light of that? Or do you just have trust that Donovan will figure it out and thus Cleveland will figure it out?
In which sense? Like, I mean, if you had to... Any concerns that you have with Donovan Mitchell have probably been levied once or twice during this run where he's been very, very good, right? I think it's just, okay, what happens to the drives? What's your counter if the drives dry up? And then is it just shot making? And is that the trade-off? Like, if he makes enough shots where a team just decides, okay, we don't really want you to do that anymore, do the drives matter as much? Like, he windmill gathered his way to this playoff run. And he was able to drive against Detroit, but, like, teams are going to put size on him. So how many of these shots are you going to make? And he made a lot of them. So it's more so, okay, what can you put around to maximize that versus, okay, I'm purely concerned that Donovan Mitchell can't do this, so his team will never win. My brain just can't ever get there. What about you?
Yeah.
Are you stuck on Donovan Mitchell? It's too short, can't win. You gonna give that take?
You cannot trick me. I will not be throwing that out there. I do think some of the, I guess, like, the playoff playmaking limitations, I do think some of those concerns are valid. And I think that's why there's been such an emphasis for, okay, we're pairing him with Darius Garland, so he can take on some of this playmaking load. Okay, we need to size up, we're pairing him with James Harden. And for at least early on in the playoff run, it turned into James Harden, we kind of need you to do more than anticipated because Donovan doesn't have it right now. In light of the size that he's seeing, to your point, to kind of limit the drives, some of the aggressive coverages that he's seeing, James, you have to just take more ownership of the offense. And I don't know how much of that was the plan. It kind of felt like to me, James, you are a compliment to what Donovan provides. And it felt flipped early on. And then as the playoff run went on, Donovan started to find it. And so that's where I'm just kind of like, will there be a shift there? If this ends up being the LeBron spot, is that enough to unlock more of the off-ball Donovan? Does that just kind of solve it? So that's when my brain's kind of turning. I don't have like a firm, this is bad, this is going to be bad. I'm just more curious. Because now that you're locked in and presumably not moving him in a year, it is more important for him to kind of be your lead guy in that sense. And so that's where I just wanted to get your opinion on that before we move
on. Understood. Forward. So you're just waiting. You're just waiting to bring the hammer down. I get it. I understand it in my head now. I will say this. So okay. One thing that you said before we move, I just, if you're going to have an issue with a player's potential to make plays in the playoffs, if they're talented enough, that's always going to be a question mark because teams are going to treat them a certain way. Like that's just that's something that's going to happen. They're going to have to battle that. If you are talented enough, a team is going to game plan for you, or they're going to challenge you to make enough plays to receive a double team or a trap or something like that. So that's never going to go away. I just wanted to add that to it. What do we got next? What else happened? Who are we talking about?
I guess we're loosely talking about the Toronto Raptors. One, just a quick salute to Kyle Lowry, who officially announced his retirement today, signing a one-day contract with the Raptors, which sent me down a rabbit hole to like how one-day contracts work. So shout out to the Deadspin article that I read earlier today about Fred Taylor when he signed his one-day contract with the Jacksonville Jaguars and just the legalities of that. So that was fun. But in general, a salute to Kyle Lowry.
Hold on. We are massively different human beings because you went down a rabbit hole on one-day contracts, and I was crying watching that Kyle Lowry video. I was touched.
It was great. Hey, man. All the numbers that mattered to him, that was very well done. So I am with you. I also watched that, but then my brain started doing the Nikias thing. I was like, wait, so I've seen one-day contracts before. I know what they represent. How does it actually work? So it was cool to kind of, you know, get the brain turning a little bit. But six-time All-Star, one-time All-NBA, which in real time didn't really feel super right. And now it definitely doesn't feel right. But either way, only one-time All-NBA. champion in 2019. You will never forget the closeout finals game where he just lit teams up. Kyle Lowry was a very good defender for most of his prime, most of his career, rather. The Charge taking King, Steve, which led me down another rabbit hole on the Kyle Lowry front, which, looking at the basketball reference page for Kyle Lowry, between the regular season and the playoffs, drew 695 offensive fouls in his career. And so that is charges plus illegal screens and whatever else. Going to Second Spectrum, that database goes back to the 2013-14 season. He has drawn 312 charges, regular season plus playoffs. You know who's second on that list?
Whom?
Ersan Ilyasova, which is just a name that I had not thought about in a little bit. But he's second with 214. Nearly a gap of 100 for who is dominant, like the smallest guy on the court for most of his minutes. 20 seasons for Kyle Lowry, had a positive on-off differential for 14 of them. And back to the Charges thing, we'll never forget the All-Star game in which he is taking charges because that's who he is. That's what he does. Real pull-up threat, great playmaker, great defender. One of my favorite point guards to watch is I'd want to give him the quick salute.
Hold on. Before we tie it, I want to give a salute to Kyle Lowry as well. And just salute, like, players like this should not be lost to history. And we should salute Kyle Lowry for the longevity, but also the evolution and being able to compete every single night on both ends of the floor and to raise that into a championship and to trust and believe and find yourself throughout your career. And so I just want to give a tip of the cap to Kyle Lowry. Unbelievable career. Well done. Now let's continue to talk about the Toronto Raptors, because my dream vision of what they could do is not going to take place because Kyle Lowry did not.
I see. Well, first, quick apology. Did not mean to move past before you got to speak on Kyle Lowry. So that's bad hosting on my part. But while we're loosely related to the Toronto Raptors, his former backcourt mate, DeMar DeRozan, is a free agent. Sacramento Kings waiving DeMar DeRozan. $10 million of his $25.7 million is guaranteed. But hitting free agency, we will find out by the end of August if that is going to be a wave and stretch for the Sacramento Kings to get them a little bit more cap flexibility or not. But either way, DeMar DeRozan is a free agent. So, Steve, very simple question I have for you. What team or teams make sense for DeMar DeRozan, in your opinion?
I knew this would be the question you would ask me, and I have a Uno reverse card today. Which one doesn't make sense? Because the fact that it's a wave means that DeMar DeRozan can be slotted into exactly what you would probably want DeMar DeRozan to be slotted into in 2026. We're not asking you to raise the ceiling of our team. We are potentially just asking you to be yourself and make this team really good. So where does DeMar DeRozan not fit, Nikias, is what I would levy back to you. Now, to my original question, because, you know, you don't want to answer a question with a question. That's not, you know, exactly kind. I like the idea of Toronto. Like, if you turn Brandon Ingram into Kawhi Leonard and then you just add DeMar DeRozan back, that's interesting conceptually. I enjoy that. I'm always going to raise the hand and say the Miami Heat. That's just like, I'm not contractually obligated to do that, but I feel like it's something that would work. But that's where it gets tricky, because it's like, depending on what DeMar would like to do, right? This is a guy who can still go ahead and get a whole lot of buckets. And once he does, teams are like, I would like for you to stop doing that. So that's where it's like, okay, if he finds the right fit, if Boston did the Jaylen Brown trade and then adds DeMar DeRozan, what are we talking about? How interesting is that? Where do we go there? If he went back to San Antonio, and it's like, you know what? That'd be fantastic. I'll go there. What would that look like?
Okay.
So I'm intrigued by a lot of potential fits. Where is the Nikias list? Because I know there's always a Nikias list. I know you got about four in the tuck right now.
There is a Nikias list. So in my notes, Steve, I do have the Miami Heat, because I think they could just use more bench. They could use bench creation for sure. And obviously, if he plays well enough, he could also close. And I think in general, you want to pair Giannis with some sort of pick and roll creator for late game stuff. Now, you would want like a better pull up 3-point shooter to fully unlock him. I think that's where like a lot of the Chris Middleton noise comes from, because of what they did in Milwaukee together. But I think DeMar would help Miami, will help raise the floor a little bit. Of the teams that haven't been mentioned yet, because I also had Toronto and Boston in the notes, I'll pose this as a question to you, but how would you feel about Denver as a spot for DeMar? Because that was one of the first teams that came to mind for me when the news dropped. yesterday. And I was like, I feel like Denver would be an interesting spot for him. And I think they just need someone not named Jamal Murray that they could trust to score and also play make. Maybe not as a starter, because like I think the defense with – we'll see what the rest of the lineup looks like for Denver. But that would concern me. But if he's coming off the bench, like that would intrigue me a bit.
This feels purely like DeMar DeRozan playing the non-Jokic minutes and get busy. Am I kinda misreading your elevator pitch? Okay. I knew it. Okay.
That's one way to do it.
Denver. Sell me on Toronto quick. What's your thought there?
I think Toronto is a similar, like, can we get another creator when Kawhi is not on the floor / not available type B? Because I think there's just going to be a level of regular season maintenance with Kawhi. If not maintenance, at least we're going to be conservative. If he tweaks the ankle, let's hold him out an extra day so we can get to the playoffs with him. And I think DeMar can soak up usage. It's like that'll probably be the main pitch. I don't love the Toronto fit, but like it's not an easy thing to. I mean, it's a pretty easy case to make. It's one of those things like I probably wouldn't do it, but I understand how.
So you're just this is not a summer of whimsy for you, Nikias.
Well, maybe not in this specific case, but I mean, if we're restoring all the feelings, if we are spinning all of the blocks, you already got Kawhi. You might as well get DeMar.
Always do it. Let me throw out two wild cards without doing any thought process behind it. What if this is just DeMar to Detroit?
That would be fascinating.
Okay.
How mad is Caris LeVert if you do that?
No, I think Caris LeVert's happy. He's out there playing defense. Okay. He'll be fine. There's plenty of time for me to get out there. What if this was DeMar DeRozan? You are a Los Angeles Clipper.
Like the LA team, I think either LA team would make some semblance of sense. At least listen to the Jake Fisher stream. Shout out, Jake. He mentioned that neither LA team seems to be in on DeMar, at least as of the time that he was doing the stream. So obviously there is time for that to change. And so that's why I didn't have them on like the hard list for me. It's like, well, if they're not interested or they're looking elsewhere, then we could just always circle back to that. But to your point, if we go from, hey, we traded Brandon Ingram, let's get DeMar back, to, hey, what if we put DeMar and Brandon Ingram on the same team? That would be kind of funny.
All right. And let's get to the spiritually correct potential landing spot for DeMar DeRozan. I take my hands. I take my eyes. I look to the sky. The Orlando Magic.
No, that can't happen. No. We can't. You know what? And on that note, we got some training. We specifically, I speak for all of us when I say we do not need that basketball fit. I am so sorry. All due respect to everyone involved. Let's talk about some trades, Steve. A couple of trades came through the pipeline since the last time that we recorded. The Washington Wizards and the Los Angeles Lakers agreeing to a trade for a big man, but not the big man that you think. DeAndre Ayton, you are a Washington Wizard. Jaden Hardy, a 2031 second round pick and a 2032 second round pick going to the Los Angeles Lakers. That gives the Lakers a little bit more financial room. I think it's a difference of around $2 million between the two contracts. But DeAndre Ayton, now a Wizard. How do you feel about the Ayton fit in Washington, assuming that he stays in Washington?
I am just monitoring what the Wizards are doing as far as they are just adding pieces and talent that I was not aware that they were going to be able to put together. But I think it is an interesting shift for a lot of these teams where, okay, we don't want to bottom out. Let's get competent play, quality play, leadership, et cetera, et cetera. But my first brain thought goes to, what do you mean the Washington Wizards have Trae Young, Anthony Davis, and DeAndre Ayton on the same team? Like, that's just not something that I anticipated seeing. Different context for DeAndre Ayton. Obviously, he'll have 1 year to reestablish himself. Wanted to do it in L.A. Didn't necessarily work out totally, but different expectations. So can he get screen roll defense? Can he help the Wizards? Can he elevate them? Alex Starr and Anthony Davis both have very much said, I would like to not play the five. So we'll keep an eye on how the spacing looks like there. But I like the fact that the Wizards can have different types of lineups in there. So you have the rolling of Ayton, you have the playmaking of Trae Young, and you move Anthony Davis around the board. So I'm intrigued. Where are you at with the Washington Wizards having DeAndre Ayton? I'm very intrigued on your opinion on this specific trade.
This is a lot of juice on your opinion. I think for me, I don't think it's a bad thing that you could have two of Anthony Davis, Alex Carr, DeAndre Ayton on the floor at all times, just from a general size, skilled big context. And I think you nailed it with the expectations being a little different for DeAndre Ayton here versus in LA, where it's like, this is the Luka slash LeBron slash Reeves team. We are just in LA. You have signed to the Los Angeles Lakers to, as you said, like reestablish yourself. You want to be in a winning context. You had the preseason comments about wanting to anchor this defense, et cetera, et cetera. You had some high notes. You certainly had some low notes. You had more mid notes than anything in LA. And so it's like, okay, what does this look like? And watch it like this is like firmly fine, I think, for the reasons you mentioned. I think the screening and rolling, the mid-range scoring, what level of switchability or activity defensively does he reach consistently is going to be something that I'm keeping an eye on. But again, you do just have like a level of skilled size that you can kind of cycle through if you're Washington. And I think because of what the Ayton contract is, it's like 1 year, what, $8.1 million, I think what it is. If he plays well, you can just keep that. And if he plays well enough to where a playoff team or a different playoff team, if the Washington hits the notes, is like, hey, we would like to add DeAndre Ayton to be like our third big or something like that. Again, not the same level of expectations of be our center, be our anchor, but can you help our front court? That's a very easily tradable contract if you're the Washington Wizards as well. So like for me, this feels like a pretty low risk, moderate reward type of move for them. And the cost is Jaden Hardy, which if you're going to have Trae Young and all of the guards and wings that they're cycling through,
all of them,
what room is Jaden Hardy even going to have? And it's two late second round picks, which we don't know what the draft system is going to be in 2031 or 2032. I think what is it, a 3 or 4 year trial period for this new system before they vote to see if you're going to keep it. So like, I think it's a fine bet for Washington. He either helps them or you can move him or you can sit him if it's an expiring deal. So I think it's fine. Okay. Any expectations for Jaden Hardy in LA, or is that more just a salary thing in your opinion?
I mean, I never lean straight salary. So I mean, if it's the pathway for Jaden Hardy, like microwave, get buckets, we need them. I don't know how much like room there is for him to play, but adding that kind of talent doesn't hurt the world, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. So if some people are out or back-to-back or something happens, let's see what you can do. It's tough for a young player where fit and context doesn't necessarily land at your door, despite you having the talent, and you don't have necessarily the wiggle room to display all those things. So we'll see. Upward inflection.
I think that's an appropriate way to put it. We'll see what the playing time looks like for Jaden Hardy if he's long there to begin with. The other trade was the Houston Rockets sending Dorian Finney-Smith and 3 second-round picks to the Charlotte Hornets. For cash considerations, Dorian Finney-Smith being absorbed via the mid-level exception for Charlotte. They're going to maintain the big trade exception that was created from the LaMelo Ball trade. But per Rod Boone of the Charlotte Observer, Dorian unlikely to suit up for the Hornets. So this very much feels like we are accepting the salary here. We may move it again. Maybe that's tradable salary, but we don't expect them to play. And so it's funny, like before Rod gave that, I was kind of intrigued, like, is this going to be reclamation for Dorian Finney-Smith? Does he actually get back to knocking down threes and defending at a solid level? Is he just healthier this year? Charlotte has a whole bunch of people in the 3/4 room. They get the small ball lineups. If he's not going to play, that takes away a little bit of juice to that conversation. So the other thing I would just add here on the Charlotte portion, 7 first round picks, 13 second round picks through 2031. That gives Charlotte quite a bit of maneuverability moving forward, I would imagine. And again, if they don't plan on playing Dorian, like, does him plus a first, does him plus multiple seconds get them in the room for insert player archetype that they need later in the season? I feel like they now have another pathway to create those kind of deals. So that's probably the intrigue for me at the very least. And obviously Houston cleared up money to help bring in Marcus Smart and others. I'm curious to see what they do on that front. Did you have any thoughts on the Charlotte-Houston deal before we move?
Well, speaking of intrigue, I hope you stay intrigued with what we're doing here at the Dunker Spot. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back with more free agency and summer league.
And we are back with this episode of the Dunkers Bias. We continue talking a little free agency before we get into a broader signings. Best signings, worst signings conversation. We'll get into the summer league after that. But Steve, a little bit more movement. Rui Hachimura said, hey, I am leaving, but I am not moving. Goes from the Los Angeles Lakers to the Los Angeles Clippers. 2-year deal, $28 million. Leave a team option on the second year of the contract. How do you like the Rui fit in Los Angeles? Again.
I mean, I think for me, one, salute to, like, I would like to not move. That'd be fantastic for me. I love that. I am intrigued with the Clippers. I said it before when you talk about their moves, like the 18-19 season where it's like, boy, I don't think the Clippers are going to do anything, and they just did stuff. I don't know if they're going to be that team. But the amount of talent they're just kind of putting in the room intrigues me to where, all right, we have a formula. We may not have the top that we had before, but we're going to have versatility. We can throw some different lineups out here. And we have people who can go score. We have people who can defend. They're going to have easier pathways to be themselves. You know, I think what Rui did was fantastic with the Lakers. Okay, now can you scale that up a little bit more? He was always ready, willing to shoot, going to get to his spot, but can you scale it up a little bit? Not sure what's going to happen with Bennedict Mathurin, as you astutely said last pod, but hey, can you scale that up a little bit? Darius Garland, we saw what he did in his minutes with the Clippers. So I'm just intrigued to see how they kind of piece this together. We'll have enough offense and defense on the floor at each time. So I'm keeping an eye on the Clippers. I'm not going to sit here and tell you they're a championship contender. I think they're going to be a fun team that are going to annoy people. And I think Rui helps with that. Let me space the floor. Let me switch. Let me get my buckets. Let me live in peace.
No, I think that's fair. Like, I think especially with the contract being what it is, very short term. And so he helps you now and or here's a pivot point for us if we want to add something else to the room. So I think you have the dual benefit there. But to the actual roster, a four that can knock down threes that may be a little bit more willing to take threes than like John Collins was, who had a good season in LA. But like you do add a slightly different dimension there. Let's add some floor spacing if Darius Garland's going to be just our primary at this point. Let's add another element of spacing if we do bring Bennedict Mathurin back and we just need all the drives that he's going to provide. Let's get a four out there that's willing to space on the winger in the corners and can just fire if those kickouts are there. And so, like, it is a move that makes sense to me. And again, it's not a long-term commitment there on top of that. So there's a level of maneuverability there. But I like it, and I'm right there with you. I continue to be intrigued with the Clippers. Like, in addition to adding Rui, said on the last pod, you re-signed Kobe Sanders to a solid deal. You also re-signed Jordan Miller. I think that happened over the weekend. And he was one of my favorite reserves to watch in the league last year. Just a real funky slash creative driver. So, like, I like what they have in the wing slash forward room. To your point, like, I don't know if the high end is like the four seed or something like that, but they should be competitive every night. And I think the offense can be electric if everyone maintains their level of health. So I'm intrigued with it, Steve. We got an offer sheet. We had a sign and trade with the Walker Kessler thing, and we'll talk a little bit about him a little bit later. We actually have a restricted free agent offer sheet on the table, Steve. The Memphis Grizzlies said, hey, Quentin Post, we would like to add you to our big room. That includes Zach Edey when healthy, and also includes Cam Boozer, who we will talk about a little bit later as well. 3-year, $30 million deal. Only the first year is guaranteed, but also sprinkling in some unlikely signing bonuses in there to further mess with the Golden State's cap, So unclear if that deal is going to be matched or not. If it is not, Steve, how do you feel about Quentin Post in Memphis?
It's fine. I mean, is that just Zach Edey insurance? Because you got Isaiah Stewart, too.
Mm-hmm.
It's cool.
It's cool.
You asked me first instead of saying how you felt about it. That was your error.
Hey, listen. No error. I'm just cackling at that. Hey, this Rui Kulig is cool. Quentin Post. Yeah, it's fine. So I am cracking up there. I think for me with Quentin Post, tall man that will screen can also space, I think, is going to be important. And I think to your point, Steve, it is a little bit of Zach Edey insurance. We will see if he is ready for day one of the regular season. If he is, then cool. And either way, like, I don't think this is going to be Zach Edey averaging 35 minutes a game either way. And I think because Quentin Post has this floor spacing element to his game, you mentioned Isaiah Stewart. We saw some Isaiah Stewart plus Jalen Duren lineups last year. I don't think it's out of the question that we see Isaiah Stewart plus Quentin Post. I don't think it's going to be a 15 minutes a night thing, but that is something that they can sprinkle in addition to like Quentin Post plus Cam Boozer and some lineups, et cetera. So, and with this being the deal, $10 million a year sounds like, ooh, but like I don't think that's a big deal. Like that's below mid level or the non-taxpayer's mid level. Only the first year is guaranteed. And so if he hits, that is a reasonable contract. If he doesn't, it's very easy to pivot out of. And again, you structure it in a way that Golden State, they can match it, but it complicates things for them. So I like the on-court fit. It, you know, continues my intrigue with Memphis as a concept this year, as we will later get to. So I think it's fine, honestly. Last individual signing I wanted to ask you.
Well, I mean, before we go to the individual signing, he was fine. It's just you are now paying him to be important at work. And I just watched the Golden State season, what it looked like when he became important at work. That's all.
Okay. Understood. Last thing I wanted to ask you about before we get into our best and worst ones or favorite, non-favorite of the summer so far. Marvin Bagley going to Denver is one that caught my eye and raises the brow a little bit.
Why? Why did it catch your eye, Nikias? What brow was raised with Marvin Bagley being a Nugget?
Because I think for me, they needed someone behind Aaron Gordon that can replicate some of what he does, at least offensively. You saw when Aaron Gordon went down and it was Spencer Jones in the dunker spot. It was just an entirely different field. Like, you just didn't have the same vertical pop. You didn't have the same offensive rebounding juice. And I think in Marvin Bagley, yeah, I'm not going to pretend that he is a world beater, but like, looking at the Washington minutes, some of the Dallas minutes, like, I thought he was pretty solid as like a third big. You get him on the minimum in Denver now. When Aaron Gordon goes to the bench, you can still have someone spacing in the dunker, lurking around. He's a great finisher still, very good on the offensive glass. You can replicate some of that. And I think for a Denver team that defensively they already don't force a ton of turnovers, any way that you can kind of shift the possession slash math battle in your favor, if you could do that on the margins, I think it's helpful for them. And I do think Marvin Bagley can help them do that. And so I like the signing, honestly, through that lens. Is that fair? Am I off?
I don't think you're off. I think it's fair. I think Marvin Bagley once again showed what he can do. Good on him for putting the work in, being efficient. I can screen. I can roll. I'll give you a little bit of defense. Here's the problem, guys.
Okay.
You have to do this in the Denver Nuggets context. And what I mean by that is, one, you're going to have to defend at a certain level to stay out there. Two, you're going to have to hope teams don't treat you like a switch. And yes, being able to be at the dunker spot is a fantastic thing. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. But if your pick and roll now becomes a switch, well, then why are we not just playing Aaron Gordon or insert wing and going smaller here? I'm going to ask an unfair question.
Okay.
What's the difference between Zeke Nnaji and Marvin Bagley at the five?
The rebounding pops immediately. I also think he's a better finisher, probably better vertical athlete.
Okay. What are some similarities between the two, potentially?
On which end?
Either. You choose.
Similar. I think I talked a little bit about the subtle defensive improvements that I saw from Marvin in Washington. I don't think teams are going to be afraid of either one of them. Mm-hmm. And so I'm curious to see what the coverage versatility is going to be like for Bagley compared to Nnaji. Because I think there's a little bit more switchability with Nnaji still, even if it isn't world-beating great. And I guess in light of that, if they do ask Bagley to switch or they just have him at the level, I wonder what the defensive rebounding looks like. Because I think if he's more in a drop, and I think we saw a little more like drop to late switch-ish in Washington in particular, if he's going to be more perimeter-based, the defensive rebounding hit probably won't be the same. And so I think you'll feel some of the similarities there. But I do just think he is firmly better than Zeke.
Understood. Now that we've got that out the way, would you like to tell the world your favorite signings, what you feel are the best signings that you've seen so far? Would you like to reveal that list to the great people out there?
Yes. Let's have some fun with some of our favorite signings so far in the cycle. Said this on the pod last week, but I'll reiterate it for those who didn't watch / listen. Dean Wade was one of my favorite ones very early on. 4 years, 39 mil for Philly. Add an actual four to the room. That should help your defensive versatility. Can knock down shots. Because he's such a good spacer or such a good cutter in general, relocator, being able to play off of whatever double teams Joel Embiid gets. If Tyrese Maxey or Jaylen Brown get two on the ball in any capacity, like, he just knows how to fill space. I think the Cleveland era certainly helped him in that regard. And so for that, Dean Wade is probably at the top of the list for me. Mitchell Robinson, another guy that I really enjoy. 3-year deal, player option on the third year. He's just a monster on the glass. Also a very good defender. And gives Boston another lob target. As Boston, as we talked about on the fun episode we did with Zach Lowe, they ran Spain more than anyone. And with the way that they can kind of mix things up with who's initiating, who's screening, who's setting the back screens, et cetera. Mitchell Robinson, as part of that, with high volume, also intrigues me quite a bit. And now you just have 48 minutes potentially of Mitchell Robinson being rude on the offensive glass. And then Nemeas Kata. Or you can flip it depending on who ends up starting. But love the Mitchell Robinson signing. And then if you're the New York Knicks, if you're going to lose that kind of size and offensive rebounding, let's add Andre Drummond for the minimum. I think you could do a lot worse than that. Like, that just seems like pretty solid work if you're trying to replicate the archetype at backup five. I like Andre Drummond at the minimum. He's going to be a monster on the glass. He's going to screen and clear space. If the corner three is any sort of real, like, I don't think teams are going to be running hard closeouts at Andre Drummond, but that is a nice little bonus to sprinkle in some random possessions as well. So those would probably be my three to kind of kick things off. What say you, good sir?
Well, let's move it to the other side here. I'm going with Tobias Harris to the San Antonio Spurs. I like that signing because Tobias Harris came from the context last year. Detroit said, we are playing defense. Let's play defense. He held up his end of the bargain for the most part. And if he doesn't, he'll likely be in the lineup with Victor Wembanyama. So it's fantastic. The effort will be there. But we saw him scale up in the playoffs. And so his ability to kind of self-create, to get downhill, to catch and shoot, I think that fits in with what San Antonio wants to do. You don't necessarily need him to the highest degree because you already have an established formula. He'll be a plus to what you do. I think he'll help the lineup versatility they never really quite got to in that final series where it's like, all right, we have to play X, Y, and Z, or we have to play that. Like, I think you can get through some more combinations with Tobias. And so I like that signing, very sneaky there. Next one I like, Marcus Smart to the Houston Rockets. Let's bring back Marcus Smart and Ime Udoka. And let's just have Marcus Smart take what he did well last year and take it to Houston. So I think it was a reminder of how good he can be defensively. I think that's going to have way more impact in Houston, a team that needs their defense to be at a certain level, and his ability to guard multiple positions should open things up. So you mean to tell me there's going to be moments where Marcus Smart and Amen Thompson are out there defending together at the same time? I think that's fun. And then Kevin Durant is not in action on the weak side. I think that's even more fun. So his ability to kind of just be a utility piece, you know, operate with the ball. Again, if he's making a drive, look who he's kicking it out to. It'll be used as a screener. I just think he fits what Houston wants to do. So I'm excited to see Marcus Smart in Houston. That's a good value setup, especially when you look through a playoff lens. And then lastly, I'll go left field even more. Give me Kelly Oubre to the Indiana Pacers.
Ooh.
Is this a massive swing? Is this an elevator? No, but I like Indiana saying, hey, we got Zubac. Pascal is Pascal. Tyrese Halliburton's coming back. And let's just make sure we have as many wings as we possibly can. So, yep, Kelly Oubre, come on down. You go ahead, space, shoot. We're going to play fast, defend your tail off, drive, do whatever you would like to do. We saw what you did in Philly. They tried to do some of what we did. We do that faster, even if we may not be a copy paste of what we've done before. Come on, bring that down. Mm-hmm. And so I think having different options in the wing room, if we're thinking like Nesmith, Nimhard, Ben Shepherd, Kelly Oubre, being able to surround a combination of those two next to Tyrese, Pascal, and Zubac, and then whatever combinations you want off the bench, I think it kind of fits into what they want to do ethos-wise. I think it helps them in the playoffs to be able to have, okay, different combinations you can go to. Because I think when the Knicks winning, everyone's going to love to knock on the door of depth and uphold the idea of depth. Once again, we talk about depth. I don't know if it's as much about depth as much as like versatility and optionality. Because if you have a bunch of talented players, but they quite literally do the same thing, how much depth do you truly have? But if you are able to kind of have different people who can help you in different series, I think that's where the sweet spot is, to where we can kind of shift to this or attempt this, or this line is going to give us this part of the program. We're going to be better defensively here. We're going to have more offense with this group. Like, I think you need to have that kind of versatility and optionality come playoff time, as opposed to just having, we have a lot of talent. Well, when you sub, I can defend you the same way. What are we doing?
No, that's a fair point. And I love the Kelly Oubre shot. I was quickly looking at the Basketball Reference page. I was like, I feel like he's played with a lot of good guards throughout his career. It's been John Wall, Devin Booker, Steph, LaMelo. You go to Philly, you got Maxey. And now you go to Indiana, you got Tyrese Halliburton. It's like, hey, I'm going to run the wing whenever we get a miss or force a turnover. Please pass me the ball. I will shoot or drive the basketball. Very streamlined offensive role. And defensively, like, we've seen him be pesky. Like, he at least has the tools for it. And so, like, I think he could be a real booster for Indiana, whether he starts or he comes off the bench and just kind of wreaks havoc. So I like the stealthy one, Steve. I guess while we're here, we're trying to cycle through, like, what the worst signings were, our least favorite ones. Like, I don't feel like there are a ton of candidates. Like, this is not 15, 16, wait a minute, player X got how much money in light of this cap boom? Like, we haven't really got that. I think for me, like, it's probably Walker Kessler by default, just because, like, over 18% of the cap top 10 center thing, and it's more so the picks that were tied to the signing trade. But as we talked about on the pod, I really like the fit. So, like, I don't actually have much negative to say, but just looking at the other options, because you were giving up the two unprotected first and you're giving up the swaps, you are losing your first round optionality to a degree. You did get 2 seconds back in the Ayton deal, but, like, you still don't have a ton of pick equity. And so, like, it's kind of Kessler by default, but I don't actually mind it. And so, like, that's kind of the one candidate that I had in terms of the worst ones. Did you have anyone that at least maybe you didn't dislike, but maybe scratched your head a little bit?
I mean, I peeled the curtain back. I put very quickly in this sheet, oh my God, I don't think I can find one. And it took me about 45 consecutive minutes of thought process. Because for me, like, I think I can understand what a team is trying to do. I think I can understand what a player can contribute to a team. So, like, to go worst, oh, this is awful. I can never really get there. I'm so sorry. But if I had to raise one, it'd probably be John Collins to Detroit. And it's not necessarily John Collins' fault. And I understand why they did the move. Tobias Harris left. You get John Collins. John Collins can slide into that role. You have a defensive infrastructure. He can space. He can roll. What happens if he can't roll and teams just switch? And that doesn't. This also doesn't unlock Asar as a roller. And now it's John Collins spaced. And it's just catch and shoot John Collins or drive. And, like, what's the elevator here outside of that? How does this boost things up?
I think that's fair. It's kind of Detroit question mark as a concept more than John Collins specifically. I feel it. Okay, let's get to some Summer League thoughts, Steve, because the Vegas portion starts on Thursday. So we'll have some reactions on Friday for the Vegas piece. But we did get some California Classic action over the weekend. We got some Salt Lake City Summer League over the weekend. We are fresh off of Cam Boozer versus Darren Peterson. We had a lot of fun. So, Steve, I will swing the rock to you. Any players, any teams in particular that caught your eye that you're excited to talk about? Are you excited for what you saw?
No. Now what? Oh. Now where do we go?
Well, I guess that means I go.
No, I'm joking. I kind of wanted to start with Darren Peterson. I think it's good. You just saw how strong the drives are, how just, okay, we're getting pick and roll. I can get downhill. I can get to my spot. Playing within his own pace. But it's mostly in the sense that I'm going to be shifty, but there's never really going to be a true turbo button unless I want to press it. And you combine that with his ability to get to whichever spot he would like to get to. I think that's fun. I think we saw a little bit of predetermining in pick and roll passing wise, but that's just natural for a guard, especially in that first game against Atlanta. I think he showcased and reminded people, yes, I can make plays. So you have the shooting, you have the ability to play off ball, you have the playmaking. I think that's just really fun. And so the comfort that he has handling the ball, the ability to get downhill, get to paint touches, but also I can just get to my spot pretty comfortably. I can have counters against your pressure. I think that was important to just kind of reestablish the type of talent that he has. And that's what you want to see in Summer League, right? You want to see what does it look like in this context and what's the growth look like? And so if you go from one game where, okay, I'm anticipating this, when you go to another game and it's, oh, I get two on the ball, let's hit the roller. That's progress. That's what you want to see. So I start with Darren Peterson before we throw the lob to you. Do you have any Darren Peterson thoughts on Nekias Earl Grey dunk?
Earl Grey fries me every time, but the pacing I think you've hit on is probably the most important piece for me. It very rarely felt like he was super sped up. And I think that's very important for a young guard to display. And to the drive portion, especially coming off the Kansas year where he's dealing with all of the cramping and all the is he playing cool, how long is he playing, is he finishing the game, etc. if this is healthy Darren Peterson, where it's like, actually, I can just kind of get into the paint or all the way to the rim whenever I want to, that's a scary proposition, I think, already. And he's going to get stronger and better and read defenses better as he gets more experience and all that good stuff. And so him just being able to get into the paint as consistently as he was, as deeply as he was probably the first thing that popped for me, in addition to just the general pacing. As you mentioned, I got to slow play this. I see what you're doing. I'll get to my spots. Ooh, I see an opening, turbo button. Now I'm 4 feet from the basket. And you don't know if this is going to be a scoop. You don't know if it's going to be a traditional layup. You don't know if it's going to be a floater. This may be up fake, turnaround jumper. He just has so many counters. I'm just like, oh, man. But I think it all kind of jump starts from the drives being back on the table for him, in the way that many people that actually do draft stuff is like, no, this is what it looked like in high school and other areas. He just was not healthy last year at Kansas. He just seems to be healthy, and that part is fun for me. So that would be what I would add on the Darren Peterson portion.
Very good. Very good. Now, I will move quickly to Kingston Flemings. I like the patience. Quick guard, lightning fast in transition, but I like the fact that I'm not going to over-rely on my speed. I'll change it sometimes, but I have some patience. So I get downhill. I see some help. I get off the ball. I see the space. I get to my spot. I see what I can make. So that's good to see from a young guard early in some of the action. And then save this one for last so I could swing the ball to you. Cam Boozer, very good at basketball. I think everyone should notice that. And I think it's pretty wild to see. I think his versatility and his passing stood out right away. And Memphis just moving him around the board was fun to watch. But hey, like, I'm just going to, like, whatever pass is there, I'm firing it on time and on target. I'm going to make sure I see these plays and make them. But the comfort that he had as far as not just catch and shoot, but let's run some, like, inverted pick and roll. Let me just get a quick pull-up off. Oh, okay. So we can move him around the board. He can be a hub. He can space. He can initiate. He can grab and go. There's a lot of things that were there that I wasn't necessarily anticipating. Mm-hmm. And it's like, yeah, I can also mash a switch if I'd like, but that's not the entire package. And some of you were sold the wrong bill of goods. What did you have to say about Cam Boozer? One box him, because I know he's excited.
The one box call is insane. And I actually got the one box. Steve runs the dunker spot. I will just say, very excited to watch Cam Boozer play basketball. Did not disappoint. I think the processing and the processing speed for Cam Boozer popped immediately. And I think when we talk about processing, at least offensively, it's a lot of how quickly can you recognize that an advantage is there and then do something to take advantage of it. One of the quieter things for me, and this is something that kind of popped for me as I was watching his drives, is how quickly you can process you don't have something and how quickly can you pivot from that. And so looking at some of the drives against the Thunder in particular, where it's like, okay, well, here's Mr. Mara. Here's an extremely tall man. Let me drive. I get stonewalled a little bit. Do I have enough of a bump to turn into a quick shot? Okay, maybe not. Let me go ahead and fling this then, since I don't have it. And like, just being able to make those reads on the fly, I think is important. In addition to, if he does get a smaller defender, yeah, I can just get downhill. I can run pick and roll against someone, get some space, and then create shots from there. And then you circle to the second game against Utah. It's like, oh, let's just run you 30 feet from the basket, inverted pick and roll, or you can just do general hub stuff. If there's some cuts, the velocity, the placement on the passes, all very strong. So that part is intriguing to me. I am keeping an eye on the defense. a couple of goaltends in the Jazz game, which is funny for me, but it does kind of highlight, oh, well, we got to keep an eye on the length and things like that. But offensively, he's fun, man. The fact that you can move him around the board to this degree, run him off actions, clear aside for him, good score and a good passer on top of that, and he processed things so quickly. I'm just super excited to continue watching this dude play. Him and Cedric Howard just on the court at the same time, it's just a funny bit for me. Look at Cedric, like, dog, you are good. Why are you here? But like, it's also helpful to have you there to build that early chemistry. So, yeah, I enjoyed the Cam Boozer experience. So I appreciate you swinging the rock on that front. Can I add another player to the list real quick? While
who else do you got? I've been waiting.
Oh, buddy. So, Steve, we did our draft episode with the great Ben Pfeiffer. I posed the question, am I crazy for being Cameron Carpeeled already for the little bit that I know? Okay. You give me wing with massive wingspan that can shoot and is a plus athlete, I am intrigued. Now, he may weigh like 86 pounds right now, and that might be problematic when we get into actual NBA games until he grows to the NBA body. But oh boy, watching this man in summer league, and the Lakers are like, hey, what if we run you off of every pin down known to man and just let you make decisions from there? And it is quick curl mid-range shot. Quick curl get to the basket. little bump slid by, you get a dunk in the half court. Take the pin down, or you trying to cheat under, I could just take a movement three. Sprinkled in some double drag form and pick and roll. The passing, I was just not ready for. And maybe this is just me that just not watching him in college a bunch, because I like to get my eyes on these guys during summer league and kind of build the base from there. But like, he got getting two on the ball occasionally, and like some of the quick slips he was able to get into with the passing, I was like, hey, man, he reads the floor a little better than I was anticipating from like this type of archetype. So the shot making was there. The drives were there. You certainly felt his impact in transition. And the passing was like a pleasant surprise for me with some of those quick hitting actions. He was able to make reads from there. So Cam Carr was someone that I was super excited about. Really showed out for the Los Angeles Lakers. If we're going to like second year guys very quickly, Yegor Jovan in Brooklyn.
Okay.
The main story for Brooklyn was, hey, he is shooting the ball a lot better than maybe we anticipated. He just cannot get to the rim, though. That might be problematic, because if you can't get to the rim, you don't really get to unlock the playmaking and the passing ability that you've been able to display early on in your career. Tell you what, he seems stronger and more comfortable. If drives are like on the table for him, I feel a lot differently about the Jovan experience offensively. Now, this is summer league, so you can't get you obviously appropriate levels of salt that you sprinkle in. But I was impressed by the interior comfort and him just being able to get downhill a little bit more. So I wanted to give him the quick shout there. Quickly on the Kings portion, whole lot of Darius Acuff. One just kind of looks the part. If we're talking about, you know, going back to the pacing bit with Darren Peterson, Darius Acuff dribbles the basketball like he knows what he's doing on every possession. Regardless if he makes a good decision or a bad one, like there's just a poise that he or confidence that he plays with that I am intrigued by. Can get to his spots. At least from 10 feet out, can kind of get to spots wherever he wants to, and he's comfortable taking step backs and different jumpers off the bounce. I am keeping an eye on how much he can actually pressure the rim and what the finishing looks like. I think that's going to be a little bit of an adjustment period. But pretty solid passing reads across the few games that he's gotten so far. The shot making is there. The shot taking is absolutely there. But I am intrigued by the Darius Acuff experience already. The defense, I already know how I'm going to feel about the defense. That is just going to have to get better. But we're baked in on that part, so we'll see. But then just a quick shout-out to Dylan Cartwell, who I think the jump off the Brooklyn game, I want to say, gets a dunk in traffic and yelled for, I think, 20 consecutive seconds. And I just got a good laugh out of that one when I was watching that game back, because that's not what that's supposed to look like. But continues to screen all over the place. Good interior finisher, good interior defender. A lot of activity from Sacramento and Brooklyn in terms of the pick-and-roll defense. I'm curious to see if that's the summer league thing or if they would just want to ramp up their activity heading into this year. But we'll go there. Quick shout out Ryan Conwell. With his shot-making in Miami, that's going to be intriguing for me. And Yaxel Lindeborg. Oh, boy. I don't think he's going to be this kind of three-point shooter to where he just literally did not miss in his debut. Certainly didn't have the same scoring efficiency in the second game. But knows how to read space, very good at relocating, cutting, getting in the interior. Transition stuff is there. Defensively, he flies around, and he already has the NBA-level body, so like he can just absorb drives in a way that other rookies can't. So that will be my very brief intrigue list on the summer league portion. We'll obviously get to more thoughts on Friday and then heading into next week as we transition to Vegas, but that is where I am at in terms of summer league thoughts, Steve.
Can't wait to see this continue to build. It's my favorite part of the season, where Nikias's excitement about some of these young players just ramps up to an entirely different level. Because I can't reveal the reason why. But get us out of here, bud.
On that note, we are going to take a break, if for no other reason, so I can figure out why Steve hit me with that bar. I'm a little scared. No, in all seriousness, we're going to take a break here. When we return, we shift to the W portion. Oh boy, the race for eighth is interesting. Paige Bueckers is on fire right now, and we got some news out of Chicago that we're going to react to. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. And we are back with this episode of the Dunker Spot as we shift to the W, and the standings continue to be a jumbled mess, Steve. Eight teams with double-digit wins right now. The top-seeded Las Vegas Aces, virtual tie with the Lynx, but they have the tiebreaker. They are only two games ahead of the five seed as we record, and we have a marquee matchup tonight between the New York Liberty and the Dallas Wings, which very quickly, Steve, because we're fresh off of the All-Star starters being announced, et cetera. Paige Beckers is one of them. She's been very good this year, hence her being an All-Star starter. She has just been nuts as of late in particular.
Do people know how good she's been recently? Do people understand how great Paige Beckers has been over this last five-game stretch? I know you got numbers. I got one of my own, right? When you are able to do something that Katie Smith did, where it's just 20 or more points shooting 50% in five straight games, when teams are literally just saying, oh, we're going to defend you at a high level, that's not easy to do. And so Paige just raised her game to a level of bucket getting that is really hard to deal with. And adding on top of that, it's the drives, it's the comfort, it's the confidence. It's I'm going to get to whatever spot I need to get to. If you would like to cut me off, I'm not settling for a pull-up. I'll keep driving. And if you're waiting for that drive, I may just continue to get this pull-up. And so it's just we're getting buckets right now. And it's funny, right? If you've looked at her stats from last year she played 33.3 minutes. This year, 33.2. Averaging 20 points. Shooting 52%. With the type of buckets that Paige is asked to get, shooting 52% and 39% from three is not easy. And so I just want to give a tip of the cap to Paige just kind of leveling up and what that means for Dallas overall in a W that, as you mentioned, is just kind of, I wouldn't say wide open, but there are opportunities to be taken. And Paige is taking these to say, would you like to have this dance right now? So I wanted to give a tip of the cap at the start to what Paige has done during this stretch and what that could mean going forward for the Wings. Because if this is going to be the Paige Beckers that we get, look out.
No, it's been Paige Beckers. It's been Paige Buckets indeed. And as you alluded to, I have a pair of numbers that I would like to present. So first, on the basic level, Steve, over her last five games, you noted five straight games, 20 points over 50% shooting from the field. 24.8 points on 64.9 true shooting, which is nuts. Four rebounds, 5.8 assists, not turning the ball over all that much, averaging a steal per game on top of that. And I think for me, the skill level has always been high for Paige Beckers. Her ramping up the aggression to the degree that it has been over these last few games where it's like, oh, she's hunting shots. She has always had the ability to take and make these. She's hunting them out with a level of consistency that should scare the rest of the league if she's actually able to bottle that. And then to the actual play type data. When the Dallas Wings have a possession featuring a Paige Beckers isolation over these last five games, 1.23 points per possession, elite number. On a possession featuring a Paige Beckers drive, 1.19 points per possession. That is an elite number. With Paige Beckers coming off of an off-ball screen, 1.15 points per possession. That is an elite number. When Paige Beckers runs a pick and roll, 1.08 points per possession. Also an elite number. Paige Beckers operating a dribble handoffs, 1 point per possession. Sub-elite, very good still overall. So to your point about moving her around the board, and I didn't even add like the post-ups to this graphic. Them moving Paige Beckers around the board to the degree that they have been, and her scoring as efficiently as she has been, and when she draws attention, being able to play make off of that attention, it just makes Dallas's offense so much more difficult to deal with because of how they space the floor, because of how they cut. Head coach Jose Fernandez has been pretty consistent since preseason, since training camp, really, talking about how important it is for them to fill those corners, fill those slots. We want to make sure we move, stay in the line of sight of drivers, etc. Paige seems very comfortable within what their spacing principles are. She knows what her spots are. She also knows how much space she's going to have to operate within her spots. And now we're just getting an insane level of bucket getting where you can't bottle it. It'd be one thing if she was just high pick and roll creator. It's like, well, she's cooking, but we know where the shots are coming from. You don't know if she's flying off a pin down. You don't know if she's flying off a stagger. You don't know if she's screening for Jessica Shepherd and what that's going to open up. It is just insane what she's able to do. So I love that you started there, Steve. And as we both kind of went to at this point, the league is just really tough right now. It's tight.
Well, I had one last page stat, a little Steve stat for you. The Wings 8-3 when Paige attempts 14 or more shots. And the three losses are just to the Lynx and the Aces. So just a small glimpse into what Paige getting buckets means to the Dallas Wings. So continue on as we try and navigate this incredibly, incredibly difficult league, because we were talking about the dream in the contender episode and the dream of the seventh seed as we record. So,
yeah. Yeah, I think a couple of days off is going to help them for sure. The 5-game losing streak has not been very fun. I'm sure they are just excited to not see the Golden State Valkyries for a little bit. That might just be the story of the losing streak. No more Valkyries for the Atlanta Dream.
they need a change. Now, Nekias, is there anyone else in the W that needs a change? Anyone?
Well, I tell you what. The Chicago Sky have decided that they need a change in their starting lineup, and we will see if the player being removed from the starting lineup also decides that she needs a change. But as we got through the pipeline on Monday, head coach Tyler Marsh moving Skylar Diggins to the bench, and we found that out before practice as Skylar Diggins posted on Instagram or to our Instagram stories. Now I'm coming off the bench with 6 exclamation points, which is never a good sign. We get the thumbs up next to it. And then at the bottom is just cool. I'm going to wager that the thumbs up is not a good sign, and that cool at the bottom does not mean that she's cool. Because the next story that we got was, you know, I've been so good and quiet. And I was like, ooh, that doesn't seem great. So I will add, there have been like some off-court things that she's been navigating as well. And so I don't know how much of that is the basketball versus the off-court things that she's been navigating and doing her best to navigate through. So I don't know, and I won't opine any further than that. But to the actual basketball portion, Skylar Diggins being moved to the bench for the first time in over a decade. On one hand, I didn't have it on the bingo card because I didn't know if the move was going to be made. But now that it is, if you're just looking at the on-court piece, I can't say I'm super surprised by the move. I think that's where I ultimately start. But before we get deeper into that piece, Steve, how did you feel about, I guess, less the Instagram
We're not starting with me. No. Absolutely not. Skylar Diggins has not come off the bench for non-injury reasons since 2013. She ain't come off the bench, period, since 2016. You said it was only a matter of time before the Sky made that lineup change. You did not say a lineup change. You said that lineup change. So while you say it was not on your bingo card, it appears you were playing roulette. What do you think about this?
Because here's the thing, to kind of put that piece into perspective and now get into the actual like Skylar analysis. I think for me, as we've done this podcast for quite some time, there have been teams and just general moves where I'm like, hey, if I was in charge, I would like to see them do this. But because of insert reasons here, I do not expect this to be a bit. And so part of me was just like, I don't know if this button's actually going to be pressed. But I had been kind of waiting on the button to be pressed. And so now that we're here, I'm like trying to process in real time because they do play later on tonight against the Phoenix Mercury, which is what a team to do that against. But I can't say I'm surprised because this hasn't been a great Skylar season on court. I think the start was impressive and you still saw the mix of drives and playmaking. But the defense hasn't been the same. Ultimately, the finishing hasn't been the same for her. And the sample has continued to grow that like this Sky team hasn't operated at a high enough level with Skylar at the helm. And so that's where I'm like, I kind of see how this happens, especially once you also sprinkle in, Sloot has came back and has looked a lot better than anticipated. Now, that is a, 3-game sample for Courtney Vander Sloot.
Yeah, so pass me the ball real quick. I saw some tweets that I've not seen from people for years here. I ain't heard y'all compliment Courtney Vander Sloot like this since the last time she was a Sky. I keep the receipts. None of y'all saying this during the Liberty run. So I look. Did I anticipate at some point Courtney Vander Sloot was going to get back in the starting lineup? Absolutely, 1,000%. Mm-hmm. But I think Courtney Vander Sloot's playmaking has been important. And the aggression, looking to turn the corner, I think it's been fantastic. I think it's been good. It's 3 games, all sub 20 minutes. One game went 0-4. I anticipated a move. I did not anticipate this move. And you got to sell something here if you're telling a player the caliber of Skylar Diggins, who, by the way, came off a pretty good game against Las Vegas Aces, if you ask me. Sydney Taylor can't go 2-for-10.
It's true.
If you're gonna start Gabriela Hawkins, can't be 14 minutes. So if when you make this move, we can talk about it. I'm sure you have the reasoning. I get it, but it better work to a degree or else what? So the balancing should be there. If you're going to have Skylar and Tosh Cloud off the bench, you should be able to have more better balanced lineups. I get it. But you are knocking on the door. Go ahead, Nikias. Ball back to you.
Yeah. No, I think that is all fair. And I think we need to see what the actual starting lineup is going to be. We need to see how the rotation shakes out from there. Because if this is Skylar moves to the bench and Skylar has 27 minutes tonight and she closes, is it still going to matter because of who Skylar has been? Probably. Is it going to be a major deal within a basketball sense? Probably not, if that ends up being the case. But this is where I am curious to see what Sky Mercury is going to look like and what the next few games are going to look like. I think as Tyler Marshall was asked about it, I think he was specifically asked, like, is this a long-term deal? And I don't think he's landed on that yet. We will see. So I am fascinated by that portion. But I think to the Skylar season, for me, I think hot start, and I think it's cooled off. And I've been trying to kind of balance, hey, this hasn't been the same Skylar. This certainly isn't the same roster context that she had last year. As Skylar talked about, this hasn't been the same off-court context for her in terms of, like, recovery and things that she's been trying to navigate coming back from injury from last season and things like that. And so it's like, how much of it is her? How much of it is the context around her? It's been an interesting balancing act. But, like, the production is the production at the end of the day. Scoring less than she did last year, or scoring at a lower rate than she did last year. Less efficient inside the arc. And I think the drives is probably where the basketball thing sorts. Or I think where it kind of circles around. Because she hasn't got to the rim as often. She hasn't been as efficient at the rim. And then defensively, she hasn't held up to the same degree. And again, to the context point, you really feel her not holding up to the same degree when you go from Ezi Madbegor and Neko Gumake to this Chicago front line defensively. It is just not the same. So, like, is all of this her fault? Absolutely not. And no one should make that argument. But some of the lapses are still there. And so as I was getting some numbers to kind of look at what Skylar's looked like this year compared to last year, again, scoring hasn't been the same. Efficiency hasn't been the same. She is shooting better from three, but not taking a ton of them to kind of offset some of the interior dip and thus less efficient overall. You look at her running pick and rolls, 0.95 points per possession on pick and rolls last year. It's down to 0.87 this year. And again, different cast of characters, but there is a dip there. The drive's going from 0.97 points per possession to 0.84, which again, not creating the same separation. Shot attempts look different. That is a dip. Drive defense has been worse. The Sky have lost their minutes, which is not a surprise, considering where the Sky are. But more surprising to me, because we see across the league, players on bad teams, we may still lose our minutes, but we are still just better with them on the floor. Like, that was a big thing with Layla Lacan in Connecticut last year, for an example, to where they lost with her. But it was massively different when she sat because of how important she was. To go from the Storm being nearly over 17 points per 100 possessions better with Skylar on the floor to the Sky technically being a better team with Skylar on the bench is astonishing to me. And again, that is not all her fault. But if we're talking about justification, like, it's not hard to build the case on, like, why the move was made. And so this is where, again, we're about to get larger than a three-game sample with Courtney Vandersloot if she does go into the starting lineup. What is that going to look like? And what kind of guard balancing are we going to see? Because I would imagine we're going to see some Sloot plus Skylar together. What does that look like? How does that unlock her off the ball? You already mentioned Natasha Cloud plus Skylar, to where you probably just want a steadier hand shepherding the second unit. So, like, I could see the pathway to it working. But I think you hit on it at the very beginning. Like, you have to kind of nail this decision. You have to nail the relationship piece. Because this can go left or further left very quickly if this does not go well.
Them numbers did not look that much different. And is this going to solve whatever you don't feel good about Skylar has done this year? And is this going to solve what you don't feel good about with the Chicago Sky? Those are the questions you should ask yourself. Is this going to do that? Are you magically going to feel better about the Sky? Are you going to feel better about Skylar Diggins' potential impact on this team?
Gotta hope so. I think that is the... I think that is the bet that you are making. I do wonder if you do have more of Skylar versus some second units, do you get more juice out of the drives? And again, I think taking some of the playmaking duties from Natasha Cloud, as that has been more of an erratic experience in terms of the blend of scoring and playmaking from her with the second unit, does it become a little bit easier with those second unit lineups if Skylar's more to help? She gets easier wins leads to more advantage creation. Now it's more Natasha Cloud and whoever else you're surrounding those lineups with attacking tilted defenses. Like, I do think there is a pathway to that creating an easier context in that regard. And I think if it is Sloot directly being in the starting lineup in place with Skylar, like, you do still just have the traditional, like, pick and roll and the general setups and the post-entry passes for Camilla Cardoso to further unlock her. And that's, I guess that's the other thing I want to say about the context, to be fair to Skylar, in light of what this year has been. I think you enter this situation, like, probably as Chicago's best player, but the hope is, because of how good you are and the skill set you provide, you should make it easier for Rekia Jackson and Camilla Cardoso to step into being, if not your two best players, at the very least your two best scoring options. And so when you lose Rekia early in the season, and it's been an inconsistent season for Camilla Cardoso, though it's certainly been on the upswing as of late, you now shift more responsibility onto Skylar. And I don't know how fair that burden has been in light of where she is right now. And in light of, you know, she talked about not having the same, like, cold tubs, hot tubs, saunas, et cetera, like the off-court amenities that help you recover and prepare for these kind of games. If you are now being tossed more on-ball responsibility in a worse context, it makes sense that the production is not going to be the same. And so this is where I am kind of balancing. I understand how you get there, and I don't know if I ultimately disagree, but I'm also not pressing the Skylar's done, Skylar's cooked button that other people may want to press. Because, like, I don't think that is...
I got you. It's just interesting because you're going to flip context. So the pluses you gave to Skylar coming off the bench, you are now reversing it to Sloot now face the starters. So you're just reversing it to a degree.
Yeah.
And the funniest part is, you go back to the Aces game, guess who started the second quarter? Skylar Diggins and Courtney Vandersloot. So,
yeah,
I don't know. We don't have to drag it, but it seems like a lot.
Understood. And so, hey, as you said up top, you better be right, because if you make this switch and DeMarcus start on a 10-2 run or something later tonight, the camera's going to pan to that bench. Tweets are going to fly, and you have to navigate some stuff. And so we will see what that looks like. But as we transition, Steve, we've already said on a few occasions, hey, the league is really tight right now. Have you seen what the race for eight looks like?
What do we got, Nikias?
I know you have. So shout out to the Washington Mystics, who are currently your eighth seed as of recording. But they are coming off of, oh boy, Mystics Valkyries was a basketball game, to say the least. Neither team had it going from three. But it was funny conceptually, and I made the joke with you and others last night, where it's like, the Mystics are super annoying. They are currently third in defensive rating as of recording. But we are going to be physical. We're going to be active. If you try to drive the ball, you're going to see 3 to 5 red jerseys. You're not going to have a good time. And the Valkyries are like, yeah, so we're the evolution of that, actually. What if we do that to y'all? While you're waiting on Sonya Citron to come back. And it's like, ah, well, that's deeply unfortunate. That could be kind of tough. So, like, the general offensive questions are there, and especially when you're missing Sonya Citron, who, if she isn't your best player, she's certainly your best offensive player or your best perimeter player at the very least. But I remain fascinated by this Mystics group overall, Steve. Like, they just win the paint. We're going to crash the glass on either end. We are going to drive. We're going to post up. We will mix in these inverted looks for Kiki or Shakira Austin, who does not mind hitting you on her drives. And so what are you prepared to do about it? Are you ready for 40 minutes of this? And then on the other end, there's just a general level of activity and physicality defensively that is not fun to deal with. Like, this is just a high floor group with a lot of young players that are not afraid of who they're matched up against. And so they hold the 8 seed right now. Do you anticipate them keeping 8? Are you at all concerned about the offense?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting concept considering they face this Seattle Storm coming up. They face the Toronto Tempo and the Portland Fire, so it could get interesting very quickly. I think, to the credit of the Mystics, they are who they are and they don't deviate from it. This is the value of identity. And, you know, that puts you in a situation where we can annoy a whole lot of teams. We can catch you if you have an off night. It might not work, but we're going to do what we do. And then you get into a night against Golden State. It's like, okay, we're going to hold you to 4 of 17 in the first quarter. That garners us a 4-point lead, 15-11. And so I think the tricky part for them is their identity doesn't always guarantee success, but it does elevate their floor. And so watching them be able to compete defensively every single night, they have young talent. They have, we're going to drive. We're going to post up. You have to deal with us on both ends of the floor. Sometimes teams are game, sometimes they're not. That does make you a little bit more steady than some of the other teams that are battling for eighth. So I don't know if it's as much, are they going to hold it? Because I think the fascinating part is they're 6-5 on the road this year, guys. If they can just win home games, which apparently I guess is like the curse of like being near the eight seed. Remember the Sparks last year? It's like they just won them up the road games and couldn't win at home. Like, I don't understand why that is, but like the Mystics are going to put themselves in a position to knock on this door all year long. I think they have too much talent. They have too much belief in what they do. And if Sonya gets healthy, that's just a dynamic that we haven't seen these guys. We haven't seen the Mystics in 3 days. Oh no, darn, we're getting beat. Like, that's not going to go away.
Yeah. No, I'm right there with you. I'm fascinated here. I think right behind them, the tempo, I think a game or a game and a half behind Washington right now. My base thought with the tempo right now over their recent string of games, like one, Marina Mabry has been very good. Two, I just want them to get healthy. I miss watching Kiki Rice play basketball. They've had to cycle through a bunch of different guard options in light of the injuries. Obviously, Brittany Sykes has been out for a while right now. I just miss the drives and the three-point shooting and the defense of Kiki Rice. I think that just makes things a lot easier for them. And I think in light of missing the offensive talent that they are around Marina, if she has the shot-making going, and if she's getting two on the ball, I think she's handled two on the ball a lot better this year. Like, she can just create so much. But you really start to feel those absences when things shift to the second side of actions, where it's like, all right, cool, Marina generates an advantage, or they give her a quick head, she doesn't have anything, she swings to the other side, and now it's Maria Conde running a pick and roll, which she can do. But it's like you're not bending the defense in the same way. And it very much just becomes, did you make the shot or did you not? And if it's a night that they don't, then it's like, okay, who else aside from Marina is going to do it? Or it swings and it's now Niara Sobley getting inverted pick and roll, which, you know, I'm just a fan of Biggs experimenting more offensively. But like, if that's number two versus like a bonus, which is what it felt like early in the year, it's a different ordeal for that offense. And so that's where I'm like, of the teams, especially with Kelsey Plum just out a month, like of the teams right behind Washington, Toronto in a literal sense makes the most sense as the team that can move past them, but also just structurally what they built, it makes sense. But they just have to get healthier. Like, I'm sorry, that's not the most exciting analysis, but you do just kind of miss some of the offensive talent in some of these stretches and some of these marquee matchups they've had.
Don't downgrade yourself. Everything's exciting to somebody. Don't worry about it. I think the biggest thing is getting healthy and being able to kind of build consistently. I think what we've seen with Toronto is a lot of good things that have not necessarily duplicated themselves, if that makes sense. We've seen the defense be physical. That doesn't mean it's going to be physical every single night. We've seen Marina be outstanding scoring-wise, and that translates to playmaking. Doesn't mean it's going to happen every single night. We've seen Sobley have tremendous games. We've seen Timmy come back and play well. We've seen Julie Alamon play well. Doesn't mean it's going to happen every single night, which is fair. Like, this is their first season putting this together. But as far as, like, we talked about the Mystics with their identity, Toronto is kind of trying to forge theirs. They have skill. Mm-hmm. They have talent. They have probably a higher ceiling. They probably have a lower floor because each game may feel a little bit differently. I was thinking about this, right? Of their 9 wins, right? Do you know who they've beaten?
Go ahead.
Storm, Sparks, Mercury, Sky, Storm, Sky, Sun, Sparks. They have done the Orlando Magic thing right now.
Oh, God. We beat who we supposed to. What about everyone else? We beat who we supposed to.
So this is a key stretch where hopefully they can get healthy and they can just kind of really sink some roots in, because they have done a lot of great things. But can this now be a consistent thing that we do? They don't play a road game until July 28th. So the time feels host, like, man, now for them to just kind of put roots into the ground and say, hey, this is what we do every single night. That's what I'm looking for from Toronto.
Okay. I think that's fair. I want to ask you about the Fire, but quickly on the Sparks front. Sorry to jump around. I am throwing my own show sheet out. They remain the worst defense in basketball and one of the worst defenses that we have seen in W history in terms of defensive rating. I don't think we've actually like had this conversation specifically. What is it when you're watching Sparks games? What is it about the defense that puts them in these perilous positions? Is it just one? Like, is there a thing that stands? Is just
breakdowns?
Just can't recover out of missed. Okay,
breakdowns. They have breakdowns, can't recover out of it. They never stop when things go bad. The effort's there. Is it consistently what you need to do? No. And then it's breakdown after breakdown. Transition defense ends up not being good. Can't contain. It's a circle of errors for them. It's why the Flajay Johnson with the storm, with the record they have, said purple and gold when asked about how she got going against the Sparks. So, like, I got to submit to the people who just said this is the worst defense of all time until proven otherwise. I thought the effort was there, but if they don't have Cam Brink and they're getting blown by and they're over-rotating and they're over-helping and they can't stop themselves, got to hold that L.
It's just incredibly tough. I think the easy button to press with the Sparks is, like, they are without Kelsey Plum. They are now 1-6 in games without KP this year. 0-3 since she officially got ruled out. And that was a 125-97 loss to the Tempo, in which Marina dropped her 53. It was a 111-87 loss to the Fever with no Caitlin Clark. And then most recently, an 82-64 loss to the Storm, in which Dominique Malanga, Awafam, Ezi Matbagor combined for 9 points on 4 of 21 shooting. And it wasn't like a high mark Flajay game either. She was solid in that game, to be clear. But, hey, man. If the offense feels more rudderless without Kelsey Plum, which makes sense, just because the drives are super important in the playmaking off of that and the three-point shooting. So, like, when you don't have the offensive floor that helps you set some of the defense and limit some of those transition opportunities that you talk about, there's even more of a magnifying glass on the actual defense, which it's so odd. It's so odd for them. I feel like early in the year, they tried to be more of a drop team, a little bit more conservative, then they ramped the activity back up, and they tried to mix in some late switching. But, like, to your point, if you just cannot contain drives, like, what does any of this mean? It doesn't matter what your pick and roll coverage is if you're getting beat up top. And then if you don't trust your teammates in terms of the rotations, you're hesitant on them, that opens up things. Then you're over-aggressive trying to clean things up, and then you're just in the hell. It is just rough. And so I'm probably a couple weeks away from me just officially taking the L on the Sparks. I want to let them get healthier, let Kelsey Plum come back. I do think we have seen in her games, at the very least, the defense still isn't great, but the offense is good enough to kind of offset some of this. This is why the Sparks have a winning record with Kelsey Plum in the lineup, but it's neither here nor there. But yeah, it's weird. I wanted to ask you specifically about the defense, because I don't think I had asked you, like, specifically what you're seeing with the group, aside from them just being bad. But to go back to the Portland Fire very quickly, your actual 10 seed right now, loses the 3 of their last 4, but they did just beat the Seattle Storm. Interesting stretch of games coming up for them. We have seen the high water marks of this Portland Fire group to where they can put teams in the blender with the way they space, the way they play, the way they drive. The activity defensively can force timely turnovers. We've also seen them turn the ball over quite a bit and their defense get dinged in certain ways. Where are you at with the Portland Fire as the sample has grown on them so far?
I mean, this is about what I expected, as far as it's going to take time for this to grow and be consistent, if that makes sense. Okay. They did a great job of buying into what they want to do early and catching teams off guard. I always said it's not that what the Fire are doing is not good and valuable. It's that what happens if the league just knocks on the door and has more of an understanding of what you're trying to do, and you have to battle through that on top of trying to figure out what you want to do defensively. And that blend, I feel like, has been tough for them during this stretch. They beat the Storm on the 4th of July on the road. That was their first road win since May 25th.
Whew.
And they have a 4-game road trip coming up starting Saturday the 11th. So it's more so, okay, I think you have the nights. Can they navigate the nights where the offense isn't humming, or does that mean a team is going to score 100 points on them? Because if you look at this, the stretch of June, the Aces did it, the Lynx did it, the Sky did it twice, and then the Mystics scored 124 on you. So, okay, we've got some navigation there. Can we make this where our offense is bad, your offense is bad, or our offense is humming, we can keep ourselves in a dogfight? Like, can you just kind of close the gap a little bit? Because I think they got a lot of players playing well. Carla Late's been incredible. Sarah Ashley Barker's been incredible. Bridget Carlton's bought in. They keep you off guard and off balance. Can they keep it snappy offensively? Can they keep pressure on you that way? And then defensively, are you certain about how much pressure you want to show, and can you rotate out of that consistently? Or are you now going to start giving automatics to teams and you end up like, no one would have thought the Sky and the Mystics would have dropped 100 plus on them in 3 consecutive games. That happened last week. So yeah. It's like, that's where it's like, okay, can we tighten the defense up and then the pressure point of the offense comes back up, or are we just going to have to kind of fight this? And they might just have to fight it. It's not easy.
Yeah. I think that's similar to the Sparks thing. They kind of need the offense to lift the defense in light of how active they want to be defensively. Like, if this was a team that just wanted to switch a bunch, you still needed to hit, of course, because you want your defense to be good. But I think it's easier structurally to, like, okay, this is what we're doing. We're just trying to flatten things out, et cetera. If you're going to be full court pressure, full court trap, big at level, et cetera, I don't know how much you can afford for games to be just up and down. Because even if you're whole serving the first half, like, that cumulative effect of, like, stamina and things, like, that just kind of kicks in for you. So I think they just need the offense to kind of settle them in a little bit. And to your point, this is where the perimeter players playing well should be helpful for them. So we will see what happens on that front. Steve, any belief in the Phoenix Mercury to make a run?
Well, I right said now. They needed to win. I said they needed to win some games, and they've won three straight as we recorded. So they got a shot. They got to keep winning games. And if Kalia Copper is going to play this way and Alyssa Thomas is going to keep being steady and you got to deal with us, I'm intrigued. They're just up against it right now. It's less can the Phoenix Mercury or the Phoenix Mercury toast. It's are the Phoenix Mercury going to put themselves in a position to knock on the door? And you now have to face the Sky, who have made a change, the Fever, who will likely have Caitlin Clark back. So everyone get your popcorn, I guess, for that matchup. And then after that, you get to go on the road. You get to go on the road and face the Las Vegas Aces and the Minnesota Lynx. So again, it's not that the Mercury are absolutely done. It's, hey, you need to stock some wins up to get yourself back in this position to have some wiggle room. But I have liked their response as far as trying to work together as an identity and saying, you know, we need to defend. Ka's been incredible scoring the basketball, which obviously helps them. AT has been steady as rock. Some would probably say this might be one of her best years, and it just hasn't had the same impact because of what the Mercury have done. But Lexi Held has helped. Like, they're getting different contributions from different people that will help elevate them, I think, as the season goes on. Unfortunately, you are in a position where it's not quite must win, but it's what we sure need this.
Yeah, they're going to need it. I think ideally, just looking at their upcoming schedule ahead of All-Star, you already nailed the first four. Like, if you could, you probably need to go 3-1 over this next four game stretch. You have Chicago and Indy at home, on the road against Vegas and Minnesota. Like, can you win those first two and then split on the road against Vegas and the Lynx? And to the Lynx front, no Olivia Miles on Monday night. And so if that becomes a, we're being conservative about this, we ain't trying to play with any lower body, anything. If that's a Lynx team without Olivia Miles and without Nafisa Collier, though she has started practicing, so who knows where that's going to be in a couple weeks, that may be more gettable than it appears right now. And then after you get through that two-game road stretch, it's Connecticut at home, on the road against the Sparks, who we just talked about. They're certainly trying to figure some things out. And so seven games, can you go 4-3? Can you go 5-2? Not out of the realm of possibility if Ka and Alyssa Thomas in particular are playing as well as they are as of late. It's going to be fascinating to see if they can dig themselves out of this hole. So that's going to be fun for me. Which, quick shout out to Brittany Griner, by the way, as they played the Minnesota Lynx last night. 29 for VG. And she's just been on a heater as of late in general. Recently became the all-time leader in block shots. I just wanted to give the quick salute there. We talk more about the Sun a little bit later. But over the last five, 16-8, two blocks per game. Nearly 1.3 points per possession on trips featuring a Brittany Griner post-up. And she is leading the W in post-ups during this five-game stretch and throughout the regular season overall. Can still get it done on that end. So just wanted to give the quick salute before we got out of here. You started with Paige. I end with Brittany Griner. Very funny for the long-term listeners that is how the split ended up. But we got it done. And with that, I say thank you for listening to and or watching this episode of the Dunker Spot. Please subscribe if you haven't already. We are on Apple, Spotify, RIP Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. Subscribe to the Yahoo NBA YouTube channel for our NBA content. Subscribe to the Yahoo main YouTube channel for the WNBA content. You can follow me on socials at Nikias NBA. You can follow Steve on socials at Steve Jones 20. And with that, we will catch y'all later in the week.